Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
All right. My goodness. Things just do sneak up on you, don't they? Hey, everybody, it's Kai. Molly's on the other end of the phone. It's a Tuesday. It's a deep dive, but a deep dive unlike any other deep dive, I dare say, Ms. Wood.
Exactly. Because I believe that we will get smarter together, but in this case, we're doing a pretty unusual thing for us, which is just sort of wallowing in current events for a moment. Today's topic.
That's a good phrase. I like that.
You know, like, and as I did it, actually, I sort of made it like a little wiggled in my chair. Like, we're just going to get down in there and just dig into the muck of the election. Yeah.
Gone too far. Okay.
Really? The muck?
Yeah, a little bit.
Make a move with me like you're a little...
No. Anyway.
Okay, so we're going to talk about the election writ large, what a Biden administration means for the economy, the recovery, the pandemic, what the transition may look like between now and Inauguration Day, a picture that is changing minute by minute, and we're not going to do it alone.
We are not. Kimberly Adams is here again and still. Yay, Kimberly.
Hey.
Hey.
Wrap around table. I'm sorry. I would
pretty
like
good,
a rewind.
Huh? Pretty good, huh? I can do that anytime I want.
Dear Daniel, I'd like you to clip that in isolation and just bring it back as a recurring sting. Thank you in advance.
So we will spend some time with Ms. Adams dissecting the last, like, so this is Tuesday. It's been a week. And we're going to talk about the week that was, also what's going to come. And I guess where I want to start, Kimberly, is like your top three takeaways from this whole thing.
This is going to sound terrible, but number one, Democrats have a problem with white people.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, our systems and election infrastructure is in dire need of an overhaul.
Mm-hmm.
And the political operative infrastructure is harming campaigns.
Hmm. Okay, so take that first one. I want you to take one and three and take them apart, because the middle one we kind of understand. The infrastructure is messed up. But talk to me about Democrats and white people.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's been so much focus on, you know, how these various groups that typically vote in low numbers turn out, and how to get them to the polls, and how do you get, you know, deal with voter suppression and get more black people to be registered and vote, get more Latinos to be registered and vote. But time and time again, you have white people who do turn out in larger numbers and are the majority of the country. They keep voting Republican. And so if I'm the Democratic Party, like, there's obviously – I'm wondering about that. Now, Biden was successful with his coalition, but they have spent so much time and money trying to convince white voters – to support Democratic candidates. And if you look at the sort of exit polling and the data, it still is that white voters, much more so than other groups, are voting Republican, and in particular supporting Donald Trump in 2016 and in 2020. If I am the Republican Party, that is alarming, that the pretty much the only large group that consistently turns out for us, you know, from the Republican Party, is white people. And that is a diminishing share of the electorate. Now, one could argue that that may be behind their sort of long-term strategy about, you know, shaping state legislatures and you know, getting a lot of conservatives in the court. But, you know, the demographics are hard to ignore in this case.
Okay. Item three. Take that one.
Yes.
Operatives.
Well, it's kind of tied to
operatives,
it.
Right. Thank you.
They're kind of linked, because why have Democrats in particular spent so much time and money trying to convince, you know, say, rural white voters or suburban white voters or any of these other groups that you kind of saw highlighted over the years, over to the party at the expense of investing in turnout for some of these groups that are more likely to vote Democratic? Mm-hmm. This was something I heard over and over again from activists and organizers on the ground, particularly that were focused on Black voters, Latinx voters, Asian American Pacific Islanders, young voters, voters with disabilities, that if you spent more money on us, you would get more people to the polls. And there is more return on investment spending money on these groups that you know are going to vote for you than mm-hmm. there is trying to convince Republican-leaning voters to switch over. Now, why does that happen? One of the arguments I heard is because most of the political operative infrastructure in the country is made up of white people, and it has chronically had a diversity problem. And so you can't really see it mm-hmm. if you're not in it, and representation is showing up in this. The other thing I'm hearing is that there's just so much money involved. You know, even if you look at something like television ads, which if you look at the academic research, that doesn't really get you as much bang for your buck as, say, you know, a really aggressive campaign to do relational organizing, getting people to tell their friends and family to register to vote and turn out to vote and getting them to follow up. I had multiple friends of mine texting me like, hey, are you registered? Did you send back your ballot? Do you need more information to help you, you know, fill out your ballot? I mean, I'm getting texts from people I know. The research shows that that's pretty effective.
Yeah.
Right.
But instead, we have tens of millions and billions in this case of dollars spent on TV ads. Why? Because a lot of these, you know, political consulting shops just so happen to have their own production companies that make TV ads. Mm. And they're expensive. They make a lot of money. And, you know, even if you look at something like President Trump saying, you know, at least there's reporting saying he's going to start his own PAC or super PAC, you know, if he, you know, finally gets through all the legal challenges that he wants to do. Why would you do that? Well, because then you can take all that political money from your donor base and your fan base and use it on pollsters and consultants and TV ads, all of these things that are their own economy that has a very strong incentive to keep itself going, whether or not that stuff works.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. It's so interesting to think of this as such a corollary to, you know, we tend to think that the political process is somehow different or not a business when, in fact, it is. And when you hear, you know, we had a similar conversation when we talked about fire and fire suppression. The idea that if we spend $1 billion on wildfires in California, somebody gets paid $1 billion. If we spend, what was it, over $14 billion on a presidential election, someone gets paid $14 billion. And if you have the same problem that you have in boardrooms across America, which is a lack of representation and a sort of academic focus on issues that doesn't necessarily relate to lived experiences, you will get it wrong. Or get some things wrong.
Yep.
So what are we feeling about the state of the transition right now? I mean, it seems like on the one hand, there's a sense that, you know, the Trump campaign is still fundraising on this, that it might be sort of an ongoing please the base that has an inevitable conclusion, but let's more dollars get raised in the interim. And simultaneously, things are starting to feel a little scary.
But that kind of gets back to the infrastructure of political operatives. Everyone involved has every incentive to keep this going as long as possible. Mm-hmm. There are lawyers making a lot of money on both sides, litigating this as far as they can. Now, of course, that means that taxpayers in these places where there are challenges ongoing, they're also paying for their lawyers to defend their board of elections, to defend their secretaries of state and their decisions. So that's money being spent. But also, you know, if you are thinking about, you know, just the online fundraising, for example, I'm signed up for the Trump campaign and the Biden's campaign text message alerts. And, you know, I'm constantly getting barraged, you know, save the election, stop the fraud. We've got a 1,000% match, which is probably not true. Yeah. But why would they need more money? Yes, for the lawyers, sure. But if you read the small print, that money is going to go to the Trump campaign, to the Republican National Committee. It can help pay down debt. It can help. And if it goes to the Republican National Committee and even to the presidential campaign, they can then redirect those funds elsewhere. And where is the next place for lots and lots of political money to go? Georgia. And so no one has any incentive to stop making money off this election. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the scary feelings about all of these people challenging what seems to be a pretty obvious outcome of the election, I was listening to Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor yesterday talking about this. And on the one hand, it's disturbing that he's not willing to, you know, see what's in front of him or at least acknowledge what's in front of him. But on the other hand, he made some valid points. If you look at, you know, the Florida fight in 2000, it did take until December before all those legal challenges were exhausted. Now, granted, it was a lot closer of a race.
And that was
one state, not many.
Right.
Yeah. But in terms of the timing, fine. The other thing is that about half of this, almost half of this country that voted for Trump. Mm-hmm. And many of them are really angry and believe the rhetoric and believe the narrative. So as we talk about healing the country, is there actually a benefit to exhausting all of these legal challenges so that anyone who possibly can be convinced feels better about the process?
Okay, but that only works if you believe that the discussion that's being had by the Republicans is being had in good faith.
No, I don't think it matters whether or not it's in good faith.
Right. I get what you're saying.
Really?
Yeah. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I get what you're saying, which is like, look, throw the red meat, right? In the sense that two things happen. One, you keep your base very spun up and eager to vote in the Georgia runoff. Two, you really do force a stress test, right? Kimberly, you're saying
if they get beat in court over and over,
of course not. But here we are, right? The second highest number of Americans in history voted for Trump. So here we are. Yeah. And possibly the only thing that's going to convince the few that are left to be convinced is a series of decisive losses in court, exhausting every effort to make it as crystal clear as it can possibly be that the election was won by Joe Biden.
I love you too, but I don't buy that. And Joe, sorry, Kimberly, to jump in here,
but look
at the ramification of one ramification of the attitude that McConnell and others in the Republican Party, in deference to a president that they have to coddle, are making. And Kimberly, as you well know, the head of the General Services Administration is refusing to sign the paperwork that will give the Biden administration access to money, space, and facilities that they can use to plan for the orderly transition of government.
None of that is okay. I'm there with you. Mm-hmm. However, the Biden campaign does not need that. Yes, it should happen, but I think that we would be hard-pressed to say that the Biden campaign does not have the infrastructure, the money, the resources it needs to get pretty far along in that process. There is going to be a point where that is going to become a real issue and really hamper the peaceful transfer of power. I don't necessarily know that we're there yet. And I don't buy this argument of, you know, like, oh, yeah, well, the Republicans are just trying to, you know, make sure that the elections are free and fair. No, of course, it's a very political, strategic decision. But that is also where we are. And if we are talking about the reality of politics in this country, which is so polarized, what difference does it make their motivations at this point as opposed to trying to get through it?
Yeah, no one's saying it's not destructive. I want to make that clear. No one is saying that we are not in a bad place as a country. We definitely are. But trying to sort of and I also acknowledge that in some ways this behavior is inexcusable. It is inexcusable to play this type of sort of political football with voters and an election that, but at the same time, like, as Kimberly said, this is in fact where we are, and maybe we can get to a somewhat better outcome if we don't just try to say, like, that's the deal, we're moving on.
Am I out of line in wanting a Republican, any Republican, to say out loud, the president lost this election, but by all means, he should pursue his legal challenges as long as they're of merit, right? Because that's not what they're saying.
Right.
They're saying a completely different thing, which tinges it with darkness and subterfuge.
Yes, that is true.
That is true. And many things are true at the same time in this election.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Fair enough.
Yes, right, fair and but the narrative that you're hearing on Fox, on One America News Network, mm-hmm, from the Republican leadership is what it is. And so if we're seriously talking about how the country moves forward, mm-hmm, you have to kind of think what might at least check off a few boxes. Or you know, if you want to take a Trump strategy, what might wear people out until they're tired of hearing of it? Because this is what this, mm-hmm, is what Trump has done to everyone else in the country, which is like, I'm going to keep throwing stuff at you until you just tune it all out. And are we going to be able to get to a point where there are enough losses and enough world leaders, you know, Republicans who do speak up, people just moving on, mm-hmm, as if, you know, things are done, to where people are like, all right, whatever, it's too far gone now. Maybe that's Pollyanna-ish, but it is what it is.
Fair it enough. Is really, yeah.
I like Fair to enough. Be a little optimistic.
Yes.
Yeah. And I also think it's interesting, as I sit here and I watch on the TV in the studio, Biden doing a press conference after the healthcare arguments this morning about the Affordable Care Act. Biden's just not even dealing with this, right? Mm-hmm. He's just moving on.
Yeah,
which is really smart. You know, yeah.
Doesn't matter to me whether he concedes or not. I got things to do, which is smart, for sure.
What about this? What about the divided government? Like, Georgia is still, you know, let us assume for the moment that the truth is what the truth appears to be, that Joe Biden has won this election, mm-hmm, and will become the president. Kimberly, what happens to COVID relief in the two scenarios that are currently on the table, that the Democrats regain the Senate with victories in Georgia or don't, and we have divided government?
Mm-hmm.
So I think if the Democrats win in Georgia or think that they are going to win in Georgia, we probably will see very little movement on a COVID relief bill, because there will be very low incentive on the Democratic side to make a deal, mm-hmm, if they think that they can get a better deal with control of the Senate. If it's looking a little more hazy, I can imagine a smaller deal between now and then. Or if it looks like the Republicans are just going to stay in charge, you might say have people saying, all right, well, this is what it's going to be. Let's go ahead and push things through with McConnell and, you know, with his demands, and Pelosi with her demands. And I imagine Trump being left out of the process as much as they can, if he allows himself to be. But then they need to fund the government on December 11th, so something could get attached to the continuing resolution. But all of this kind of is hard to talk about, because we're losing more than 1,000 people a day.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And the economy is really struggling. This is about to get worse. And so we had this rare moment of bipartisanship early in the pandemic when things got really, really bad. And so things may get bad enough between now and inauguration that they have to do something. I don't know what that would look like yet.
Hmm.
Yeah. It's hard to imagine
that was
them
extra grim, but
no, I mean, yeah, it's hard to imagine them not getting bad enough, because it's hard to believe that they're not bad enough now. And
well,
yet here
clearly
we are.
They're not, because there's, yeah. And it's also really icky to be talking about this as a political calculus,
mm-hmm,
because I still want to believe that, you know, we've got human beings on Capitol Hill and in the White House who have some level of empathy. And to imagine that it's all just playing politics with people's lives is a downer, which is probably not the best perspective to have as somebody who covers Washington and should know better at this point.
Well, okay. That jury segment brought to you by Kimberly Adams, that covers Washington and regulatory policy and the money of politics in this economy. Thank you, Kimberly.
And how it's destroying everything because people with their own entrenched interests are perpetuating things that hurt the rest of us. Yay.
Yay.
Well, let us know what you think we should have asked Kimberly. Make me smart at marketplace.org. We'll maybe get something on What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. Otherwise, we're coming back. Thanks, Kimberly, for taking the time.
Thanks, Kimberly.
Bye. See ya.
No problem.
Bye.
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 Sheesh.
I know, totally. Wah, wah.
I know, right? And I'm the one who gets the dark place thing all the time? What the hell
no,
is that?
No, it's good. It's good. It's all a back-to-basics conversation. It really is.
Yeah. Like, for sure.
Because an election tends to reframe a lot of things. And as you know, I'm hot on framing for the next upcoming who knows how long. So let's reframe.
Life. All right. Let's take a break. We're coming back.
Yep. All right. We did a news fix just now. So
a big one.
A big one. So we're calling that a jumbo-sized news fix for today, and we're going straight to the mailbag.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first-time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
So we're going to do that. Cynthia is a military spouse. Her spouse is stationed in Germany, and she writes that she was moved to record a voice memo for us when Kamala Harris was announced as the vice president-elect. Here you go.
Like you, I've had a lot of moments of despair and anger and rage over the state of, well, everything, but especially the situation that women like me are facing in 2020. I had a 12-year career that I couldn't bring with me to Germany. Jobs are hard to find here. And then COVID-19 made the childcare situation untenable anyway. I've had a lot of frustration and grief, to say the least. Getting word of Kamala's election as a woman of color to the executive branch brought me unadulterated tears of relief and optimism and inspiration, the first happy tears that I've cried since March. If she can get there, maybe I can too. Anyway, thank you both for making us smarter and helping us smile through this tough year. It's not over yet by a long shot, but I have reasons to hope.
There you go.
Yeah.
We can just let that sit there. That's a nice little item.
Definitely.
You know? Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
All right. Jordan from North Carolina wrote in after he heard our show on gerontocracy and suggested another framework for the U.S. government.
The fact is, whether by design or not, our current political landscape provides weighted voting and political power to people from rural areas and states. This situation is only likely to be exacerbated due to projected state population trends. This leads to an increasingly likely situation that caps the party representing more overall voters at a ceiling of a divided government where they may control the executive branch and even the House, but the Senate may well remain largely out of reach. Much has been written and said in recent years about the structural advantage Republicans enjoy because of their support among more rural states and voters, but I think we should introduce this somewhat awkward term, ruralocracy, as shorthand for a government that prioritizes and grants disproportionate political power to its rural residents. No shade to our rural friends and family members, but does it make sense to have a thumb on the scale in their favor? Thought you guys might appreciate. Take care and stay sane.
Yeah, let me say it again, because it went by sort of fast in that North Carolina drawl. He suggests a ruralocracy, which, I don't hate that. And let me also, just for the record, if you're a listener to The Daily, and I know I keep pimping this podcast on this podcast, but they did a thing on the Electoral College a week or two ago that was really interesting, and it lays out exactly how the structural advantage is to the rural states. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely.
Totally fascinating. Yeah.
I mean, I think we are at the point now where in the Senate in particular— it's like 60 or I'm making up these numbers in some way. I'm guesstimating, but it's something like 60 or 70% of the senators, like 70 senators represent like 6% of the population. I mean, it's something like the spread is astonishing in that way. And it is really true. And it's that is a really, really good point. I'm grateful you pointed out because it is really true. And also rural occupancy is hilarious.
All right, here comes Robin. Here comes Robin Colorado. He's a manager at a day program that serves adults with disabilities. And back in March, he says he continued to have to go to work in person, obviously with extra safety measures. And he wanted to tell us what that was like as a frontline worker.
Hi, Kai, Molly, and Kimberly. I really can't imagine working in a job where I had to go remote after the pandemic started. And I really respect people who were able to make that transition from being in an office where all of their tools for doing their job, their colleagues, and just their normal pace of life was, and then the next day it wasn't, and being so isolated and alone during the craziness of the pandemic. Yeah, I just don't think that I could have handled being on Zoom calls all day. And we're certainly appreciative of those who are working from home, decreasing the traffic for us a little bit and preventing the spread in other ways.
Aww.
Yeah, so, you know, and we're appreciative of the people who have to keep going in because that's real. That challenge and that burden is real.
Yeah,
and you know, Zooms are terrible, but it's nothing like actually having to go out into the economy these days, I'm sure.
Erica Phillips sent me a tweet from Ezra Klein, actually, today. The rough math is that if the Republicans win the Georgia specials, then the Democratic Senate minority will represent 20 million more people than the GOP minority. If the Democrats win, the Senate will be 50-50, and the Democrats will represent 41 million more people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. They call it malapportionment. Senate malapportionment.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
Really interesting topic. All right. What else have we got? Because I accidentally went to a different tab. Let's see here.
The
Make Me Smart question.
Go ahead.
The answer, in fact, the question, of course, is what is something you thought you knew, but you later found out you were wrong about?
Something I thought I knew, but later found out I was wrong about. I used to think that there were some institutions whose mission was so important and whose values were so virtuous that the people chosen to lead and manage these institutions could be implicitly trusted to do the right thing and be above petty self-interest. I believe my church was what I later found out was that it is the very veneer of wholesomeness which in fact attracts people who wish to use the reputation of these institutions in order to advance their own interests. But what I came to realize was that just because the leaders of an organization do not often live up to the high ideals of the institutions they represent, it does not mean that those ideals are not virtuous, nor does it mean that the organization is not valuable. These institutions, including our government, need our love and support, even when sometimes the people leading them don't deserve it.
Fascinating.
I think that's fair, right? I mean, you know, if much of my, you know, ire the past number of months has been directed at the institutions of our government, I think that's a lesson for me. I'll take that.
Yeah. The really, really simple version, this is John from California, by the way, and the really simple version of that is something that we used to say when I was growing up, and it was basically like in certain, that my family would say, like, you never trust, what is it? You never trust the tax man or a do-gooder.
Right?
And I also used to know somebody who said that the only truly selfless person in America is a firefighter. Like everybody else does what they do because they get something out of it. Like if you're, you know, a member of the clergy, you have a sense of self-righteousness. Obviously we're generalizing here. If you're, if you become the mayor or the president, like it's public service, but you get a lot of power. If you're a cop, maybe you really like to carry a gun or you get, again, some power and some sense of superiority. And then the firefighter just runs into a building that's on fire, which I always thought was kind of fascinating. They get a lot of, well, anyway. Anyway, thank you, John. Thank you to everybody who wrote in and sent us all those voice memos. It's working and it's
good
so
stuff.
Wonderful to hear all your voices. Like we said, please send us your answer to the Make Me Smart question at makemesmart@marketplace.org. And of course, your questions for What Do You Want to Know Wednesday, which I still think could be a jumbo.
Could be a jumbo.
So many questions.
We will have to see once we get there. Make Me Smart, which is this podcast, is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Erica Phillips does our newsletters, also the smart speaker skills that we do.
Today's program was engineered by Daniel Ramirez and mixed by Garrett Lang. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez, geniuses, both of them. The senior producer is Donna Tam. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. Shout out to Ethan Peretz! Going rogue.
He's never going to be able to leave. That's the problem.
He's really stuck. He's really stuck.
I know it's been 17 years on this internship, Ethan, but you simply can't leave.
Hope you like this job, buddy. Forever.
Oh, man. Boom. There we go.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.